This is Front Row on BBC Radio 4. When the American writer Nicholson Baker published his first two books, The Mezzanine and Room Temperature, some critics complained that they were not really about anything, but were meticulously detailed accounts of such everyday events as buying a sandwich or feeding a baby. More recently, the objection has been that Nicholson's books said too much. One non-fiction work, Human Smoke, criticised Churchill and Roosevelt for failing to negotiate peace with Hitler. Another, Double Fold, attacked the American library system for killing books in favour of new technology. He also published two very sexually explicit novels, The Fermata and Vox, the latter of which was given as a love gift by Bill Clinton to his intern lover. Baker's new novel, though, is a largely uncontroversial monologue by a poet, although he does make one bold proposal.
If we could just stop for 1 year, if everybody could just stop publishing their poems. No more. Just everyone, every poet, just stop. But of course, that's totally unfair to the poets who are just starting out. This may be their Wunderjahr. This may be the year that they really find their voice. And I'm telling them to stop? No, that wouldn't do. But wouldn't it be great?
Nicholson Baker reading in the voice of poet Paul Chowder from The Anthologist. A couple of Baker's books describe him just sitting down with a laptop and seeing what comes out. Is that in fact how he writes a book?
I'm embarrassed to say that is a lot of what I do. I sit down. In this case, I sat down, but I sat down having set up a video camera in front of me and hooked on a lavalier microphone, or maybe I had an audio. I did it. Almost all of it I did recording it in some way because I wanted the book to sound more spoken.
So when you got these recordings of yourself, of improvising it, did you then transcribe those?
That's hard. Yeah, I did. I did an awful lot of transcribing. Then I realized that you could do it Sprechstimme, you know, you can do it talk typing. So I would go out to the garden, let's say, and sit in the white plastic chair and talk it, but type it at the same time.
Because most of your books have had the first pronoun, have had I in them, we tend to suspect that a lot of it is you. I mean, in this case, I think it isn't. But have you ever written poetry?
I have. I wrote some poetry in college. Well, one about a beehive, I think. One about a pregnant woman standing in front of a fan. I was kind of pleased with that one.
Do you remember any of it?
No, I don't. Well, I think I remember she holds... I mean, no, I don't
Go on, do it.
It.
You almost
her
going
to... Her pregnant
she holds...
belly to the blast, I think I said, because blast rhymed with something. And don't let's think about that. Let's hurry onward from that.
And because in The Anthologist and a lot of the other books, your style is digressionary and the implication is that it's coming out very naturally, but presumably it isn't as simple as that. There are huge digressions within digressions that you then cut out later on.
Very tempting to peel away and do something over in the different zip code, postal code area, and then come back. This time I tried something else new, which was to use a random number table. You can go on random.org, you know, and they give you random numbers that are based on, I think, atmospheric turbulence or something. Very beautiful. And so I had this list of random numbers, and so when I would go and do the speak typing, I'd assign a random number to that chunk. And then I would use those random numbers to put the chunks all in order in this enormous manuscript. And obviously the order was all wrong, but it was an order. So I had a moment of pure chaos, and then I had to kind of find new connections between things.
Did you think, when you ended up with those visual recordings of you reading it, did you think of doing anything with those? Because in the modern world, people would say put them on the web or whatever. But it's difficult for you, isn't it? Because you are committed, famously committed, to the old-fashioned book.
Well, I'm not committed that, in secret. I'm not committed that much. I had fantasies that it would be this kind of, at one point, that some of it could become this kind of autobiographical movie. And I had grown a big beard to kind of establish that I was not me, but was this character. Of course, he's still 80% me, but...
Also, you still have the beard, so are you still him, or...?
I'm blushing now because you're looking at me, but I trimmed... This is nothing. I looked like, you know, George Bernard Shaw on a bad day. My wife looked at some of these clips that I'd made. I had a, you know, high-definition camera, and I was very serious about it. And there was a tremendous amount of throat clearing and all the things that you learn not to do probably in the second week of acting I had done. But I'm a person with a, you know, I have to imply a spoken voice, I think, rather than be someone. I don't want to be seen.
This is one of the paradoxes that interests me, because you clearly are shy, and yet you, for the last 20 years or so, you have very often been involved in big public rows or scandals. First of all, with Vox and Fermata over the sexual content. More recently, which you talked about in this program, the book in which two people fantasized about assassinating the then President Bush, George W. Bush, and then your public campaigns for books and for paper and libraries. Yeah. So it's a strange thing for a shy man to get quite so involved in quite so many controversies.
I like to make my little make trouble. I mean, I guess, I don't know. It doesn't feel that way at the time. It feels like I'm trying to tell the truth or trying to, in the case of the sex books, I mean, it just seemed to me that there were things to be said that hadn't been said, and now they've been said insistently, so I don't do that anymore.
And you must be asked this endlessly, but that moment when it was revealed in the Star report that President Clinton had given Monica Lewinsky Vox, and suddenly this writer, I mean, it's quite an unusual thing to happen to a writer, I would think. Was it an exciting moment or a bewildering moment?
It was a very exciting moment. Long ago, the President of the United States receives a copy of my book and maybe even thumbs through it. I mean, that's an exciting thing. It happened about 5 years, I guess, after the book had had its moment. So it didn't help me in any... It didn't help the book particularly. It just was an exciting thing for me to be part of a scandal.
I think it's about 10 years since we first talked about the American newspaper repository. You were trying to save... old newspapers. It's even worse now because the newspapers themselves are largely about to go out of business. But how, to what extent was it successful, saving old newspapers?
The specific job, which was the newspaper collection in Collindale, was taking a terrible hit. Where they were auctioning off their American newspapers. Well, we ended up buying some of them, and they were stored away in a mill in a small town in New Hampshire. So that was successful because they've all gone as a gift to Duke University. They're part of the rare books collection. And if you want to go see what Joseph Pulitzer, probably the most important editor in American history, printed on a given day, you can go to Duke University and see that one surviving copy. And of course, I'm sad to see newspapers now facing financial ruin because they're giving it all away for free. And I don't know what to do about that. I don't think anybody's figured it out, because if you put up a paywall, then nobody reads your stuff. And newspapers are like every other organization. They want to be read first and foremost. I'm unhappy about the whole thing, but I think it will all be sorted out somehow, because there's the basic appetite, which is for words on the page that tell a certain story.
Finally, in the later years, and in fact, in interviews I did with them, Norman Mailer, John Updike, Gore Vidal, all announced the death of serious literature, basically, drawing on this tempting fact that it used to be Updike on the cover of Time magazine, and now it's Dan Brown, and so you can see why they think that. Do you... And it's always tempting for older people to say there's going to be nothing after us, but was there anything in that, do you think?
No, I really don't. I think that that would... I always kind of made an inner sigh when I would see some pronouncement by an elder writer saying that everything is dying now. And because, honestly, I don't think any of these novels are the things that America is really going to be proud of in 100 years. I think that the sitcom is our art form. When we talk about what is American literature in 150 years... anyone who had been caught in an ice cube and woke up then might be very surprised. It might be the people who have been slaving away writing Mary Tyler Moore episodes and Dick Van Dyke episodes and Friends and Cheers and stuff like that.
Nicholson Baker, The Anthologist, is out in hardback now.